I've known lots of sorrow in my time. I've suffered great pain, my poor heart has often been mended, only to be broken again. As I face each new day of a dreaming of a love
That's vocalist, songwriter, pianist, arranger, journalist, and human rights activist Nina Simone with How Long Must I Wonder? It's a universal question. It's from her 1971 album, Here Comes the Sun. Nina Simone died in France, where she had been living as an expatriate, on April the 21st, 2003. She was 70 years old. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find informative. A month after Israeli extremists firebombed a Palestinian home in the West Bank village of Douma, killing a father and his 18-month-old son, President Reuven Rivlin yesterday affirmed to leaders of the settler movement that, contrary to international law, he said, Israel had a right to build settlements as, quote, a basic fact of modern Zionism, unquote. Our guest today is going to help us understand the many layers of meaning in that statement. He's Mark Levine, professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine, and distinguished visiting professor at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Lund University in Sweden. And thank you so much, Mark, for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Well, let's talk about that statement. It's a very powerful statement, and given President Rivlin's political background as a so-called moderate, it is all the more interesting to hear him say this, and to the group that assembled at his home, a group of leaders of the settler movement. What does this statement mean to you?
Yes, well, I think we need to clarify a bunch of things. First of all, Rivlin is a fascinating character. I don't think you could ever call him moderate from an American perspective, because he is a nationalist who believes that Israel should have sovereignty over, you know, the entirety or the vast majority of the West Bank. So in the American lexicon, normally moderates are from the Labor Party and they support the Oslo peace process and some vague idea of a two-state solution. He most definitely is not one of those. He is a nationalist in the Israeli sense, meaning he supports full sovereignty over the biblical heartland of Israel. But he also is someone who even Palestinians will admit is an honorable man. He understands that Jews can't rule over that many Palestinians without offering them essentially some form of political equality. And certainly also has tried to deal very openly with issues of increasing intolerance, extremism, and racism in Israeli society. So he's a combination. He is certainly a man who at least publicly cares about trying to deal with the repercussions of the very system he wants to ensure is permanently enshrined in the occupied territories. That also creates an obvious paradox. On the other hand, what he's saying, I was trying very hard to find mentions of it in the Hebrew language media, and there are very few, if any, in the main Hebrew language newspapers, because what he said is not news in any meaningful sense to an Israeli context. The official policy of most every government for the last 15, if not 20 years, more or less, has been the assertion of Israeli sovereignty over large swaths of the West Bank. And certainly the official platform of the Likud party, and they're the most moderate of the other nationalist parties, so all the nationalist parties have as their, you know, explicit political platform the retention of the West Bank as a permanent part of Israel. So nothing he said was that interesting in Hebrew. In English, it was a perhaps more public admission that Oslo is dead, there's no point even talking about it, and Israel is going to permanently retain a large swath, if not the entirety, of the territories. And to me, what was important was his use of the word sovereignty. And he didn't say it as if he was arguing it. He was saying it as if it's already a fait accompli, the way Russians are talking. You know, the way Putin talked about Crimea, essentially. It's not up for discussion. It's sovereign Israel. And now we have to deal with the repercussions of it. How do we allow Jews to settle but maintain a certain level of basic rights for Palestinians and keep the violence and hatred down? And that's where I think he is now. And good luck to him if he can figure that one out.
Well, what was particularly interesting to me was the use of the word modern. He says, "I love the land of Israel with all my heart. I have never and will never give up this land. For me, our right to this land is not a matter of political debate. It is a basic fact of modern Zionism." What is that? What is modern Zionism?
I don't really know. I don't know if we can parse the words that, you know, people like him say at meetings when there's sort of unofficial recordings or, you know, I mean, modern Zionism is like saying wet water, right? Modern Zionism is a modern phenomenon. So defining it as modern really doesn't say anything other than repeat what it is already, you know, at its core of the definition. It's a quintessentially modern nationalist movement. So perhaps he's differentiating it from the ancient Israelite or ancient Jewish claims to the land, which were not grounded in an immediate return, right? It was waiting for the Messiah before the return. Or when Jews did return, it was not as holders of sovereignty, but only as people who were allowed to live in a land that was under the control of non-Jews, whether, you know, it was the Ottomans or before then, you know, all the Crusaders or whoever had control over the territory before the advent of the State of Israel. But I don't think, I mean, it's not a meaningful term in any sense, because it is modern. So perhaps he means progressive or democratic, or he's trying to tie it to the good things that people imagine when you say the word modern.
Well, it is interesting, like you said, here is a person who even Palestinians regard as somebody with a sense of reason. But on this matter of the occupation of the West Bank and Palestinian territory, he is absolutely clear. There is no debate, he says, about that. You've written books, you've done a lot of work in Israel, you're part of this movement to gain some kind of independence and sovereignty for the Palestinian people. The book that you have written recently, One Land, Two States, Israel and Palestine as Parallel States, in Rivlin's statement, basically, he affirms that there will be no one state.
Well, he's affirming there'll be no one state, except that what he's saying, you know, once you argue that the land is ours and we have sovereignty over it, then you're essentially declaring it's one state. So you can't eat your cake and still have it. You know, what he's trying to do is have it, eat it, but no one knows he's eaten it. And so you can still pretend you have it. But the cake's been eaten, right? Israel has completely eaten and digested the West Bank. It is Israel. The idea of there being two territorially separated states was a fiction 30 years ago, and it's certainly, you know, not even the realm of fantasy at this point. So, you know, I don't presume to speak for any Palestinian who has to suffer through this occupation for half a century, but from my perspective, Palestinians should, you know, be happy at his statement, because at least it shows them the parameters of where the struggle should continue. And clearly what he's saying is, you know, we have all the power, which is true. You're never going to have your own state, which is true. And that was never in the cards. So the struggle is now one man, one vote. The struggle is a clear South Africa type, or pre-civil rights U.S. type, or Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Teo. It's a struggle over full equality and democracy for everyone living from the river to the sea. And that's actually, ironically, perhaps from a Palestinian perspective, the struggle they can win. They were never going to win a struggle over sovereignty with Israel, because Israel is far too powerful. It has too many friends. They have no allies, no power, very few weapons. And Israel could play that game for the next 100 years quite happily, as it's already done for the last 50. But once you get into a struggle for rights, universally recognized rights that Israel has an obligation under international law, and there's no haziness about it, unlike the laws of occupation, for full democratic equality, that's a battle that even the most extreme right-wing Israelis will have said publicly at different points they know they can't win. So their end game is to just postpone it for as many years and even generations as possible, and until things evolve on the ground, hopefully to make that, you know, to change the calculus, or change the rules of the game, so to speak. But from my perspective,
Mark, that a statement like that coming from a president of a country in direct contravention of international law with respect to the establishment of settlements in the West Bank, that is a contravention of national law, one would expect that there would have been some kind of comment, some kind of reaction at the international level about that, because of his stature, if nothing else.
I don't even think the Palestinians bothered to react. I mean, this is said every day by every major political leader. I mean, Naftali Bennett says it before he has breakfast most mornings. You know, everyone in the Israeli government says this all the time. It's our land, we're not giving it up. So for whatever reason, I think Agence France-Presse picked it up. It maybe because it was the weekend or something, it got circulated. But I mean, it's not news in the sense that there's nothing in what he said that hasn't been said 1,000 times over. What to me the interesting question is at what point are Palestinians going to say, okay, we get it. Where's our passports? You know, and then the battle, as Ehud Olmert already admitted, you know, once the worst thing for Israel that could ever happen from a Zionist perspective is the day Palestinians agree with the Likud platform. And that's because that's when it moves directly to a South Africa apartheid-like struggle. And you know, the thing that shocks right-wing Israelis is why this hasn't happened. What the brilliance of the Israeli management of Oslo, which was never going to produce a Palestinian state, was that it got Palestinians to focus on nationalism and on separate sovereignty as the cherished goal that has to be maintained no matter what. And as long as they did that, no matter what Israelis did, they couldn't take the logical, they couldn't fight them on the terrain that they would have the advantage, which is the terrain of rights and citizenship. They had to fight back on the terrain of separate sovereignty, which, you know, was like a 10-year-old playing against Roger Federer or something. You're just not going to win. They had no chance to win. The game was rigged, and they were never going to win. But because the entire political edifice of Palestinian leadership, both Hamas as well as Fatah, are built around Oslo at this point and around trying to secure something that is impossible to secure, the longer they play the game, the better position Israel's in. And it's to the point where Israel can be very honest now about its true intentions, and it still won't change the Palestinians' leadership strategy, whether it's Hamas or Fatah, because their only raison d'etre for existing, whether it's Hamas or Fatah, is the achievement of this mythical sovereignty. Once it's about rights within a single state, then they become nothing, right? They lose all their money, they lose their funding, they lose their raison d'etre. No one likes Fatah, no one likes Hamas. They're considered brutal, corrupt, and inept. So no one would vote for them, either of them at this point, if they tried to become a political party within a broader, greater Israel. So they literally, the only way they can continue to exist and draw salaries and rule over people to whatever extent they do, is in the, within the myth of the struggle for a Palestinian state. And that's really the dynamic. So they go on and on. Israel is, can be as honest and blatant as it wants now, and the game just keeps going. And of course, the Israel, the U.S. and the Europeans have no interest in stopping the game. So they'll keep paying the salaries to keep the Palestinians quiet and keep it all managed. They'll, and the Saudis and Gulf monarchies will give Hamas, you know, enough money to keep going and fight off the more extreme elements. So everyone basically is happy, except for obviously the average Palestinian.
This statement by Rivlin comes a month after this attack, the firebombing of this man's home, killing him and his 18-month-old son. And it suggests a kind of revving up of extreme nationalistic fervor, terrorism. What is the state of affairs? You've been looking at this for a long time. What is happening now? Do you see a rise in this kind of supranationalistic extremism?
I don't know if I see a rise. I think that a lot of people say that. But let's remember, in 1994, when Baruch Goldstein engaged in that horrific massacre in Hebron, what was the response of Yitzhak Rabin's government? It was to build more settlements and close down Hebron and make the people of Hebron suffer even more, right? So, you know, the response to extreme violence by Israelis has always been more violence by the government and more settlements, just to show that, you know, despite what this person did, we're not going to stop doing what our goal is, which is to settle and control the territory. I think on the ground, if you're Palestinian, there's no difference, right? It's, you know, the occupation continues. This was a terrorist, quote-unquote, killing an 18-month-old baby. But, of course, the Israeli state, through its security forces, kills Palestinians every other day, right? And they burn children to death when they drop bombs. That's how usually people die. When a bomb hits their house, if they're not blown up, they're incinerated. So this is nothing unusual, nothing new. It's just a person not, you know, in uniform and under orders from a state authority who engaged in it. And of course, in a sense, it's a very utilitarian, or it's very useful for the government, because it can then differentiate itself from the quote-unquote Jewish terrorists, even though from the standpoint of violence and oppression of Palestinians, what the Israeli state engages in on a daily basis, you know, is exponentially worse and larger than this horrific murder of the family. I mean, if you look at Gaza, you know, entire families of 10, 20 people were incinerated and people were cheering. So what's the difference? There is none, ultimately. So I think these events, these kinds of violence, I mean, this is also part of the sheer brilliance of the narrative. Whenever Palestinians commit violence, it can be used to justify the occupation. And whenever Jews commit acts of violence not sanctioned by the state, it gets to be used to justify the occupation. So literally, it's a game, no matter what card is played, the state can use it to its advantage. That's why I believe personally that the only chance Palestinians have to get any kind of basic rights is to stop playing that game, to try to switch to a different game with different rules. But as of now, all it does is reinforce how moral you know, the government is compared to the crazies. But I think on the ground, from a Palestinian perspective, it's utter nonsense. The occupation goes on. The machinery of the occupation never changes. It's ever intensifying. But it hasn't fundamentally changed in its goal or its impact for, you know, almost 50 years.
Just today, Israel began releasing hundreds of African migrants that who were held in a remote detention center in southern Israel. As many as 1,700 had been held there. And it raises the question, most of them are from war-torn areas like Eritrea and Sudan. And the question that arises where they are concerned, number one, are the rights that they have as human beings under the Geneva Convention, but also as Jews. Is there a distinction in Israel about who is a Jew?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how many of these migrants are claiming to be Jewish. I don't know that there are historic Jewish communities in, you know, left in those areas. And if these migrants are claiming to be Jewish, obviously the precedent of the Ethiopian Jews, the Falashas, has sort of laid the groundwork for conversion, you know, ritual conversion of people that the Orthodox rabbinate says, you know, doesn't feel are sufficiently Jewish if they're not white. Obviously, you know, the people who are clearly not Jewish, which was obvious, was a huge share of the Russians who came in the late 80s and 90s. But for various reasons, no one really cared as long as they assimilated in and their children were raised Jewish. Within a generation, they were all perfectly Jewish. For the African migrants, it's a very different situation. You know, there's two issues here. One is, what are their rights as refugees? And they're certainly refugees under international law and according to protocols Israel has signed. And even if it didn't sign, it's customary law, so it would be obligated to treat them with certain levels of dignity and respect. I think the Israeli government realized it can't continue to hold them indefinitely. It costs too much and it resolves nothing, and there's really no way to send most of them back. So it's going to have to figure out how to deal with this. This is a product of the 90s. This is a product of the systematic change in the Israeli economy towards the neoliberal model, when they closed the economy beginning in 1990 physically to the majority of Palestinians who used to work in the lower rungs of the Israeli Jewish economy. They opened it to foreign workers who they believed would be cheaper and also less politically troublesome. So Thais, Bulgarians, all kinds of Africans, Filipinos, all kinds of people started coming into Israel and working like everywhere else in the world, very cheaply. And like everywhere else in the world, a lot of them got there and said, well, this is better than where we come from. We're not going back. And, you know, in most societies, this causes problems. Israel is in no way unique. Certainly the Arab countries are 100 times worse than Israel in terms of their treatment of migrants. But the particularity of Israel as an ethno-national state where one religion that is not the religion of the vast majority of the migrants is dominant becomes highly problematic. So that's the reason why they're easy to marginalize. They also lived in certain areas like the older part of Tel Aviv, where there became, you know, pockets of crime and other issues that that the majority of Israeli society obviously was not thrilled about. But this is the same dynamic of migrants everywhere in the world. So there's nothing unique in Israel's case. And in fact, compared to most Arab countries, its record is, however bad we might see them treating the migrants, is still far better than the Arab countries that surround them.
You've been very active in the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, known as the BDS movement, aiming to put pressure on Israel to comply with several stated goals, including ending of Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, full equality for Arab Palestinian citizens in Israel, and respect for the right of return of Palestinian refugees. How has the BDS movement impacted domestic policy within Israel?
Within Israel, I don't know if it's certainly, I don't think it's impacted domestic policy. It's become a lightning rod for the government and the right wing in Israel to use in defining a new set of dangerous enemies. As several commentators have pointed out, as Iran has started to fade because it's clear there'll be a deal and they can no longer use Iran and the nuclear issue as something to mobilize international opinion, especially Jewish opinion, BDS has become the existential threat, I think is the word that Netanyahu or other leaders have used. And it's a way essentially to rally, not Israelis, but certainly the international Jewish diaspora and especially the American Jewish community around the cause of supporting Israel no matter what. And to that extent, certainly the Israeli government succeeded in getting wealthy Jewish leaders in the U.S. to raise tens of millions of dollars to fight this so-called specter. The problem is that in so doing, it's further alienated the leadership from the base of American Jews who were far more liberal than the leadership, and especially among younger Jews, it has really alienated Jewish millennials and today's Jewish college students. You know, an unprecedented number are walking away from the idea of Israel as something worth supporting, or those who are more active are creating new organizations like Open Hillel, or even joining Students for Justice in Palestine, which, you know, there's a joke that Peter Beinart, who, you know, probably the most famous American liberal Zionist writer there is, joke that, you know, at most college chapters, if you go to the local Students for Justice in Palestine, most of them are Jewish. Most of the students are Jewish involved in it. So, you know, you have, I think, young American Jews reclaiming this mantle of the Jewish role in the civil rights era and the pride of being at the forefront of the most important movement of their day, which American Jews once could claim. And they're seeing Palestine as that issue today. And you see that also with young blacks and the Black Lives Matter movement and other black leaders who have come out vocally behind BDS and against Israeli policies. So I think in some ways you're seeing a fulfilling of the circle, or, you know, a conclusion of a circle where, you know, there was a couple of generations where Jews became much more conservative, much more part of the mainstream politically. And I think there's a younger generation now who is far more politically progressive than its parents and more radical and more like the Jews at the beginning of the civil rights era.
What are you working on now, Mark?
Well, now I'm working on several projects, one of which is continuing to build on the work the team I helped direct of Israeli and Palestinian scholars who put out the book One Land, Two States. We're trying to further develop the idea of parallel sovereignty as a way of allowing Jews and Palestinians to both have sovereignty over the entirety of the territory without infringing on each other's basic rights. That's something that we've received a decent amount of support from various Scandinavian governments and sources and hope to develop further. And beyond that, I'm still working on projects that are looking at the role of culture in a lot of the social and political conflicts across the region today, Morocco and Tunisia, Egypt, Palestine, Israel, Iraq, and various other places. So just trying to study how culture impacts larger political struggles.
Thanks for being with us, and thanks for sharing your thoughts today, Mark Levine.
Thank you for having me back. Hope to be back soon.
Yes, will do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll take this break, and when we come back, a fresh start for Ferguson's court system. But is it justice? Right after this.
I can bring back the faces of the lovers
So I wonder, as I often wonder, how long will I wonder this time? You're listening to PRN.FM, and the program is Lead Stories. Yours truly, here at the mic, Eutrice Lead. 5 months after the U.S. Department of Justice skewered the police department and criminal justice system in Ferguson, Missouri, for targeting blacks and treating them largely as a source of revenue for the city, newly appointed municipal court judge Donald McCullen yesterday announced a series of changes, chief among them dropping all arrest warrants for minor crimes and infractions issued before December the 31st, 2014. Well, it's a good sign, and I'd like to discuss, as good as it is, it's a great start, but is it justice? Will there be justice? You may recall that the Justice Department, then under the leadership of Eric Holder, right in the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown a year ago this month by a white police officer, now a former police officer, reviewed the criminal justice system in Ferguson, Missouri, as well as the police department, the functioning of the police department, and issued a report. It didn't do anything but issue the report, and the report was Eric Holder's parting gift. He resigned shortly after the report was issued. Well, here's where we should start. This report confirmed what people in Ferguson had been saying for decades, that they were targeted. They were targeted for minor crimes all the way up to very serious crimes, of course, but routine kinds of crimes, broken headlights, cars illegally parked, small things like that, that resulted in a blizzard of tickets. And that was the routine. And then, of course, over time, because they were unable to pay these tickets and fines, the amounts started mounting. And it became a case where many of these minor crimes or infractions, they're not crimes, minor infractions, would now result in their arrest. And this, they kept saying, was a way for the city to make money. It's the same, let's say, in New York. People would be surprised to know that communities of color really are carrying a huge burden of delivering revenue to the city. And how does that happen? A simple thing. Alternate side of the street parking, let's just say. On one side, you can park for Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 7 to 11. And the other side, Tuesday and Thursday from 11 to 7. And your life in New York City, if you happen to own a car, in most areas is about moving your car. You're 1 minute late, or you forgot, or you woke up late. You have a nice little gift waiting for you under your windshield wiper. And then it becomes, you know, they add on to it and add on to it so that your lateness in moving your car will now be a major problem financially for you. So the city of New York, and I did a story some time ago about this,
how certain communities were literally targeted for a blizzard of these kinds of tickets, because the police were used not to ensure safety to these neighborhoods, and they've just hired 1,500 more police officers, but the police are the revenue collectors for the city. They have nothing to do really with safety. It is about assigning them these jobs. Go out there and bring back as many tickets as possible. You have shown your efficiency as a police officer based on the number of tickets you have issued, not based on the number of crimes you've prevented or the safety you have assured, but the number of tickets you can write. So a police officer, in many cases, and it's not just in Ferguson, this is par for the course across the country. Every African-American Latino community could tell you this is what the deal is. Minor things that could result in tickets, they write tickets real fast. And then the police officer would be said to be a good law enforcement officer. See, two different concepts. In African-American Latino communities, we have law enforcement. In white communities, we have policing, community policing, two different approaches. Well, that's what the people of Ferguson, Missouri had been saying for a long time. The Justice Department decided, well, okay, we'll do a big study. And it basically put in writing what people had been saying to them. And then, of course, it got the Justice Department stamp of approval and supposedly its authority as a credible document. And this was what caused the judge, Donald McCullen, who is African-American, to take some action yesterday. And it is considered a sweeping overhaul of Ferguson's criminal justice and court systems. But there are a couple questions here, and we have to give credit where credit is due. Here we have a judge just coming in, and he has decided that he could make a change, and he has done so. So you give him some credit, and you say, thank you. It's a good start, but that's what it is. It is a start. Because while it does give some breathing room, while it does communicate some measure of justice, while it does extend to the community the sentiment that says, we understand that you have been wronged, and here's a way that we can start afresh. Well, when you're doing that kind of work, you arbitrarily pick a date, and he did. He picked December the 31st, 2014, as the cutoff point. If you had any arrest warrants issued because of these minor infractions and your inability to pay and so forth, we'll work something out. It's a concession. He's not saying it's a done deal and we're wiping the slate clean. It's gradual. He's saying we will use this as the cutoff date and we will reexamine these outstanding tickets and so forth, and we will use this as the cutoff date. And that's, you know, in the world of bureaucracy, it's a gift. It's a good move. It's a nice sign. I am interested, however, in the systemic issue here. And the systemic issue has to do with the Justice Department. The Justice Department should have known, because that's one of the functions of the Justice Department, to collect statistics, to examine these statistics in order to see trends that are disturbing. In the same way that the Justice Department supposedly should have been on top of this question of police brutality and use of force, because It is the agency to which all the police departments presumably report and send in their statistics about all these different things that would indicate trends, such as police killings, the reasons for them, the breakdowns, the statistical breakdowns of these killings that would expose certain trends. This is not rocket science. This is what they're supposed to do, which it should have done, certainly in the city of Ferguson, because it had to dismantle a police department next door to Ferguson. I forgot the name of the town now. Because the trends were very disturbing there. They suggested a pattern of corruption, a pattern of abuse. But the Justice Department is quite selective in how it chooses to move. And in cases where we see the Justice Department actually moving, you find the correlation is that people have had to take to the streets and take extreme measures, if you will, to call to the attention of authorities what the authorities should have known a long time ago. So in Ferguson, look how many decades passed of this kind of treatment where we have, in effect, collusion between the criminal justice system and the police department to target the African-American community in Ferguson and in St. Louis generally, and to really look at these communities as in the way that a predator regards prey. The Justice Department should have been on top of that. It should have seen the signs. It should have gotten that information from the information it collects from all over the country. There are people, they're big departments, they're getting paid a lot of money to do this very thing, but it's not being done. And if it is being done, the Justice Department is withholding movement for political reasons. In the same way, you can say as banks. All these banks that have been acting in rogue fashion, gangster fashion, committing all kinds of crimes involving trillions of dollars. And the Justice Department's response is uniform, and that is, well, we will fine you. Obviously, the banks are able to pay the fines, but the Justice Department won't do what it needs to do, which is to rescind their charters, to shut these banks down after repeated offenses, to remove their charters, cancel their licenses to be in the banking business altogether. Shut them down. They have the power to do that. Instead, the politically expedient thing to do is simply to settle with the matter of paying the fines. Same thing here that we have in Ferguson. These are palliatives. These are things that have perhaps more symbolic value than real value. Because the real value here, if you're going to start, let's say, from December the 31st, 2014, well, what happens to somebody who predated that by 5 years and 10 years? What happens to those people? The city's criminal conduct over all that time will have been forgiven and forgotten. So you take people who just in the immediate past were given a bum deal. And these people will now speak for the class and the masses of people harmed over decades by the same kinds of criminal action and activity by the city, the police department, and the courts. How often have we heard of cases where prosecutors just railroaded people into prison, where the judge obviously knew it or suspected it, but let it fly. Where the police officers testifying were criminal. And where the people who have been harmed ended up doing decades in prison, many of them spending years in solitary confinement. And then when their lawyers persevere and they have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and they have to do all of this in order to seek justice, which should have been immediate. It should have been immediately clear to a judge presiding in the case that the prosecutor is really not on the up and up, that the police officers are not on the up and up, that this situation is rigged against the defendant. That will cost somebody, and many people had this experience, of decades of their lives. And then if they should be so lucky as to persevere after those decades go by, they get an oops, we're sorry, here's a couple, we'll give you $4 million, $2 million, and we're kind of sorry. Now that should cure everything. We'll give it to you, but then the other 29, 59, 100,000 people just like you, well, they don't matter. You will now be the stand-in, the symbolic stand-in for everyone. And more importantly, you will be the symbolic stand-in for the system's profession that it really cares. It really wants justice. It really is fair-minded. And it cannot allow injustice to occur. So this is what we are seeing. We congratulate the municipal court judge, Donald McCullen, for at least doing something to suggest that the people of Ferguson have been heard, and that to the extent that he's able, within the confines of the system that he operates in, he can do this, and this is what he has set out to do. It's a very courageous thing. We ought to commend him for taking that action. But we also need to be clear that this is not necessarily justice. Justice requires systemic rooting out of the evil that has been race-based all these years, that has targeted people, that has caused them great pain, that has been persistently and consistently unfair. That is where we need to go. Firing people who have done evil things, exposing the extent of corruption and malfeasance and misconduct, and punishing those who have done these things and gotten away with it. We had a situation, just to illustrate that point, in New York City, where the prosecutor knew, she had to have known, that the young men accused of raping and beating a woman to within an inch of her life in Central Park were not even there. I was the editor of a newspaper at the time, and we exposed that when it happened. We went and talked with their parents and people who knew them. There was no way these young people, young men, were involved in this crime at all. But Donald Trump took a full-page ad saying they should get a death penalty. And the mayor, Ed Koch, demanded that these people be found and punished to the full extent of the law. And the pressure was on for the police commissioner to prove that such a crime would never, ever go unsolved under his watch. And they did everything against the book, contrary to law. And they did it in conspiratorial fashion to achieve the desired goal, which was somebody had to pay for this crime. Somebody had to pay for the crime. And they snatched up these young men. To this day, has there been any investigation of the police officers who conducted the so-called questioning and the canvassing of the neighborhood? How did these young men get selected? Who did it? Under what conditions were they questioned? How did they end up as suspects? And then the prosecutor building a case, not caring whether these were the correct people to prosecute, and proceeding with a bogus prosecution that predictably yielded the desired result. Here are black and one Latino guys, and they raped a white woman, and guess what? The order has been fulfilled. Justice has been served. Has anybody involved in this entire process, the criminal justice process, the police process, the prosecutorial process, has any of them been called to account or paid a price for sending these young men for 15 years away from their families, jeopardizing and forfeiting their futures? No, quite the contrary. The prosecutor is now a major deal. Is teaching law at Columbia University. She's been rewarded for a corrupt prosecution. This is happening every day. So when we see these things, we have to also understand that Judge Donald McCullen is operating within himself a racist system. And all the more reason to say, well, he has shown some degree of courage here to indicate that to the extent that he's able, he will try and do something right. We know that he doesn't control the system. We know that his hands are tied just the same. He may have the title of municipal court judge, but he comes out. I mean, the Justice Department actually verified how racist the system is. But he's done a good thing. However, but we keep this in mind, it is also symbolic, and it is also in a way of saying that the system is making the required amendments to its racist past and trying to do the right thing. So he may very well be informed to do this deed by just that sentiment that he is standing in for the system. We don't know. All I say is it was a good thing to happen, but we need to watch it. And we need to be really clear, this is not a systemic response to what really ails Ferguson. It is a palliative, a symbolic gesture to basically later say, look, we got the report, we heard the word, and we made the required adjustments. That's how it works. So we'll see how it goes in Ferguson. We'll see whether other things are to come. But we also see, more importantly, that none of these things would have happened on their own. And none of these things did in fact happen on their own. Eric Holder had to be compelled into action. And even so, he didn't complete the task. He just wrote a report and said, well, you know, you guys figure it out. I'm out of here, and returned to the law firm that kept his office handy and open and available, anticipating that after his round of service in the Obama administration, he would come back to the law firm and make more money for the firm and for himself, of course. And he comes back as a partner. So his stint as U.S. Attorney General has worked really well for him. Has it worked really well for the people? I don't think so. I think that's the point. But this is how we see how the system works, how it adjusts itself from time to time, strictly on the basis of the degree of pressure that people put on it and the insistence that their needs be met, especially in the area of justice. Thanks for listening and joining me here today. Keep it right here on PRN.FM and let me know what you're thinking at leadstories@gmail.com. Please know that it is a pleasure and a great privilege for me to be in your esteemed company every day. Bye-bye. See you tomorrow.
How long?